All right, I guess we'll go ahead and get started back. We're at 101, so I want to have you guys out of here before tomorrow in a timely fashion. We're a little behind. We'll cut where appropriate. We're going to do some exercises. We're going to try to do that maybe, maybe not. We'll see. My children will be applauding now when I say we're going to skip the exercises. You know, when we school them, they go, good, we don't have to do anything. So they always cheer because Dad's long-winded, and they know that. All right. Well, let's talk about let's just quickly run through some of these tips for effective news writing. I think the first rule one: use an economy of words that prefer the specific over the general. Be committed to the specific versus the general. And you see my examples there. Just yes, local EMC customers received a bit of unwelcome news yesterday. Their electric bills will soon increase by as much as $25 per month. Boy, that's bad news. I don't like that, right? No. Blue Ridge Mountain Electric Membership Corporation, or Section 3 of the government use code, yesterday filed for a fourth-class rate increase to be distributed among clientele. That was an actual new lead from my hometown newspaper. But I want to know, $25 a month, well, why? I want to read on. Well, I wouldn't read on the clientele, because the people in my hometown, they probably wouldn't be able to pronounce clientele. They think that's a French word or something, and so they really wouldn't get that. And you need to write so people get it. That was Norman Cooper again, another classic. I think, sorry, it may not have been. It was somebody in my paper. Let's just say that. My favorite line ever in my hometown paper, I don't remember who wrote it, but I remember the lead was Mark McGuire about him breaking Roger Maris's single season home run record back in 1998. And it was this: standing on the edge of immorality, Mark McGuire. And I'm like, oh, was he about to cheat on his wife or something? Was he checking out a chick before he went in to hit? I mean, it's just a hilarious. And I wonder, what was he doing there on the edge of immorality? He was standing on the edge of immorality, not immortality, which I think is what he intended, but standing on the edge of immorality. He was about to kill one of those fans, or he was winking at a woman, not his wife, before. I don't know what was going on, but it was great. And someone sent an email, and the man was not happy that they had made fun of his story. Or in the same issue was a man fell into a large raven. I'm like, oh, boy, I bet that was a big bird. It hurt him. So anyway, it's supposed to be a ravine. He was injured when he fell into a large raven. So anyway, I'm sorry. I couldn't resist it. All right. And here's the classic. I love this lead. Organized crime lord Leo Gambini got his last night. Four slugs in the back. That's good because it communicates. I mean, this crime lord was murdered by somebody. You know, so not that that's a good thing, but that's a good lead. Mudd Smith passed away after an extended illness. Don't say passed away. Say died. That's a therapeutic. I think it's a blush to pass. We don't want to admit that we were weak and we die. Just passed away. No, just say he died. I mean, that's more specific. Passed away is like kind of this ephemeral, vapor-like existence, and, you know, I don't like that. Fuzzy, a period of unfavorable weather set in. Clear, it rained every day for a week. Do you see how simple that language is? It rained every day for a week. You can't do any better than that. That's gold. I mean, it tells us it's been really rainy lately here. Every day for a week. It's very simple language, but, I mean, it's elegant. John Piper writes about that in his essay. Eschew obfuscation. In other words, write clearly and concisely. Do not write a news feature story or even an opinion piece as if it were John Owen's death of death. And I love that, but it almost killed me to read it the summer I took off to read it here. It was wonderful. But you use simple language and an economy of words. Avoid jargon. We've been over that a bit. Government speak, attorney speak, even theological speak will help you achieve number two, which is being clear. No, God is propitiated. This is a great, important biblical word, though. So theologians start to jump on me, and I have to give up my Reformed Theology membership card. But if you use it, explain it in layman's terms. I love the word, but explain it. Yes, on the cross, the sinless Christ bore God's punishment that sinful men deserve to bear. That's beautiful, isn't it? No, local government passed a SPLOST yesterday that will lead to further taxation of the electorate in Union County. And you can guess where I got that again. So it's a veritable gold mine. And this may have been a previous editor. Okay, so yes, Union County residents will pay more taxes and shopping locally next year thanks to a 2-cent increase in sales tax. Okay, you can't do a whole lot better than that on writing about a SPLOST, which is a special local option sales tax. But don't say that nearly. I mean, you don't need to say that at all. No, the magistrate and the legal defense team will voir dire potential jurors on Tuesday. Yes, the judge and attorneys will interview potential jurors on Tuesday. And so voir dire, if you don't use the Latin in a news story unless you're prepared to explain the Latin, and don't use it in a small town newspaper. Bottom line, if you must use jargon, briefly define it. Always assume the reader will not know. When you preach, always assume, unless you're preaching at Southern Seminary's chapel, and God help you if you are, because you better get it right, because I don't want to ever be invited back here to do that. It'd be really scary. But you know, explain it. Assume they're not going to know what it means. I do this all the time in sermons. I'll say, and a lot of my people know. I mean, they've been theologically solid for many years, but still, I won't assume, because when I do, I have people come, what did you mean by that? So just, I mean, I think that's good pastoral wisdom, even here. Just assume they don't know. And if the person who does know, they'll skate right over it, and they won't think you're talking down to them. And again, show versus tell. Use particulars, not avoid generals, not just in leads, but throughout your story. Yes, lightning flashed across the sky from east to west, lighting up the moonless evening as Russell Moore navigated his family's SUV around the serpentine, two-plot blacktop that crawled up side of Bald Mountain. It's a little wordy, but not bad. No, it was a dark and stormy night. And I love Snoopy, but no. I mean, tell me about the dark. Show me the dark and stormy night. This is one of the most important rules. Edit, edit, edit. Write and rewrite. We were talking, one of the brothers and I were talking about how to be a good writer. Can you improve? I have to improve every story. I write and rewrite as much as a deadline will allow me to do so. This book on Calvin, I have rewritten the first chapter of that. I don't know. I need to let it go. I really do. I mean, Dr. Haken and I send the chapters back and forth, but I'm just not happy. Of course, I know he's going to be reading it, so I don't like that, first off. And, you know, a veteran historian like that, who's glad he's a dear friend, he's been very helpful, but I'm not happy with it. And I finally will have to let it go. I think I have actually let it go. But write and rewrite. I mean, edit, you never are going to write the perfect story. And eventually let it go. Use active voice. Employ pregnant verbs. Within 5 minutes, fire swallowed the entire first floor. Swallowed. That's a good verb, right? That says a lot without saying too much, without using too many words. Swallowed. You know that the fire is vicious. Fire just, you know, like King Kong or, you know, or something like that. But always use active voice most of the time. Smooth flow. Establish clear connection between lead and story. We talked about that. If A, then B. Just make sure there are connections all through the story. Common fallacies, and I get a lot of these. This is an excellent little book, and some of you got this. If you didn't get it for $2 on Amazon, go get this. You'll be glad you did. Now, some people hate this book, some grammarians, but I love this book. For just common kind of writing I want to do, I want to write theology and church history for lay people. This is going to be great. This is a good little elements of style, a guide to style. Strunk and White. My first day at the Daily Newspaper, my editor slapped this into my chest, and not this one, but it was a white cover, and said, go, this is the gospel, go and memorize it, learn it, live it. And I started reading it. There's some humor, good humor in here, but it's good. It's very, very helpful. So some of the fallacies I got directly from this, it's well written. You'll enjoy reading it. E.B. White is very witty. That's right. Yeah, absolutely. Good stuff. My kids love it. But here's a common fallacy. Big words are superior to small words. Now, you learned this in English probably in high school. Just forget it. That's not true. Avoid at all costs attempting to impress your reader with the size and breadth of your vocabulary. Let me throw out a name for you. R. Albert Mohler, Jr. Do you know, how many people do you know that are smarter than him? I've known lots of smart people in my life. I've never met anyone who's more brilliant than him. Never, ever, anywhere, at any time. And yet, when I read his blog or I read his books, guess what I don't see? A lot of pedantic, difficult to understand language. Because it's so clear in his mind, I'm convinced that he's able to make it very clear for you and I. Because it's clear to him. He gets it big time. And your reader will appreciate it if you show them that you get it. Well, I am absolutely certain that there are many, many reporters, many journalists in this country who don't get it at all. They don't understand the question or the answers. And I don't mean North Georgia News. I'm talking about Atlanta Journal-Constitution and others. They don't even work to understand it. They just write sort of about something that someone told them. And if you were to quiz them for 2 minutes about it, you would exhaust their knowledge about it. But Dr. Mohler writes clearly, concisely. Russ Moore, another guy, probably number two in the brilliance there, just total package. Great writer, great speaker. But how many, when he preaches in chapel, do you have a hard time understanding that? I mean, my 75-year-old mother in Georgia loves to hear Russ Moore preach and Dr. Mohler. Has heard it many times. She'll listen to them because they get it. And because he talks about Loretta Lynn, partly, and my mother likes that. And I do too. But avoid big words. I mean, just show off your vocabulary. I would edit that out. When I'm going to if I'm your editor, that's going out. Unless you need to do that. You won't impress, you'll just confuse. And this is from Strunk and White. Two different styles of writing about a passage from Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament. The first is written by George Orwell, the second taken from the King James Bible. I love this. Objective consideration of contemporary phenomena compels the conclusion that success or failure in competitive activities exhibits no tendency to be commensurate with the innate capacity, but that a considerable element of the unpredictable must inevitably be taken into account. Now, the prize for anyone can tell me what that means who don't read has not read that. What does that mean? You got me. I have no clue. Well, here's what it means. I returned and I saw under the sun the race, that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all. It's hard to beat that, isn't it? Now, do you see any big words in there? No battle, strong, bread. Wow, that is very elegant, isn't it? That's beautiful language. It's very, very elegant. Flows well. There's good active verbs in there, but it doesn't talk much about objective consideration of contemporary phenomena. And your government does this all the time, don't they? Because they don't want you to understand. Well, the objective phenomena of consideration here, and you're just going, okay, turn the channel here. I don't get this at all. It's the, you know, voir, the witnesses here. But the witnesses are clueless. Secondly, exclamation points add emphasis. No, they add silliness. Don't use them in nonfiction writing. Just don't use them. Get a witness here. We used to have a rule here. It's okay, you can buy one of these in your career. It's going to cost you $1 million, so spend it wise. I've yet to use the $1 million. I mean, unless it's a quote someone shouting, I mean, you need to emphasize. But I mean, just, you know, something you're saying about how wonderful something is or marvelous, which, you know, all right, great. But they don't add emphasis to nonfiction writing. They're just silly, I think. So don't do it. It's kind of like smiley faces in your story. It's kind of like, that's really sweet. So it's sweetness. It's the same. There's a parallel here. I know, I'm a curmudgeon, but you guys knew that the minute I walked in the door and talked about Johnny Cash or whatever I talked about. One word leads are powerful. No, they're choppy. Remember, it's better to show and not tell. Again, go back to my earlier example of a question mark. What, when, where, and why? And I just thought, I give up. Who, what, when, where, and why, and why do I care about these? I don't know. And I still don't know what the connection to the story was, but because they just used one word. Or you'll say vision. Jim Smith has great vision. Well, just take that first word out and say Jim Smith has great vision, because that doesn't really draw me into the word. It just kind of irritates me more than anything. Number four, variety in attribution verbs is a good thing. Use attributions such as he laughed, he chortled, he scoffed, he pondered. They add variety. And I've had an argument. One of our old reporters, not anyone guilty in this room, but wanted to do this. He'd say, he chortled. And I said, what are you talking like this? He's laughing. Is that how he talked? Well, no, but it adds variety. It doesn't add variety. Just say said. He said or he wrote. Because the reader skips over that. He chortled. He doesn't talk. We don't really talk that way. My children do, but I don't quote my children except on Facebook or something. So he scoffed. He laughed. You could say, so-and-so said something, comma, laughing. Now, that's good, okay? Because you show that they were, maybe this wasn't serious. That's different than he laughed. But that was a common fallacy I saw in young reporters. They'd say he laughed. I'm like, what's he talking about? Just like this. So anyway, you get the point. Adverbs and adjectives add color. No, they add wordiness and little else. They tell but do not show. No, he was an extremely tall man, but yes, he stood 6'5" tall and ducked his head under the door mantle as he entered the room. And I was actually thinking about the time Tom Nettles hit his head on the ceiling of my house when we had him over for dinner. It was my wife and I mean, I'm not the tallest guy in the world. We lived in Bilbo Baggins' house, and complete with a round door, so he bashed his head on the ceiling. He really did, and we had dinner with him with an ice pack on his head. Not the way to impress your PhD supervisor with your hot, warn him of the hobbit hole if you live in one of those. And we definitely did. It was an apartment for short people, those vertically challenged people like us. Anyway, don't use adjectives now. Just flowery, because it didn't say it. Show me. Again, show me, don't tell me. Six, verbose writing compensates for lack of factual information. This is a cardinal sin. You cannot write around a lack of good information. I said this earlier, and it will be obvious to the reader, and he will move on, that you have nothing to say, you've not said it in a way that's compelling, and he'll stop reading your story. 7, watch out for common grammatical pitfalls. Now, here's now the first one, the split infinitive. Now, I see this everywhere, Dan. This has become basically acceptable usage, and I've reconciled myself to this, the split infinitive. I see this everywhere I read. But it used to be, you know, Star Trek, to boldly go where no man has gone before. You know, Star Trek used it, but we shouldn't. Split infinitive places a word between two and the infinitive. But it's accepted practice now. So I think I've reconciled myself to that one. I mean, with exceptions. Subject-pronoun agreement. This is a big one. This mistake is rampant in writing. Wrong. Boyce College celebrated their 10th anniversary yesterday because there it speaks of, modifies people, a group, right? Boyce College is an it. It's an entity. It can't be a there. And I hear TV people do this all the time. They speak that way. They'll say, Georgia won their game yesterday. Oh, the whole state, they played a game and they won their game. Great. We always want Georgia to win, all the people in Georgia. But no, Georgia won its game yesterday. You see here, the University of Georgia won its football game yesterday, and the Georgia Bulldogs won their game, because Georgia speaks to the team, and that's a collective. So, but that's a very common mistake, and I hear it on the local news almost every night. And I always love to, always feel sinfully satisfied, self-satisfied probably in pointing that out to myself. You know, like, geez, subject-pronoun agreement. And I probably do it. I'm sure I do it myself. I'm from the Deep South, so it's endemic. Beware of coveting inspiration. You're not an apostle. You're not an inspired writer. Again, one of my friends suffered from this, and I have at times. Writing takes hard work, and Olasky says writers are susceptible to the sin of coveting, so-called inspiration, and not working unless they have it. Write when you are at your best. I write at best about 1 o'clock in the morning and about 8 o'clock in the morning. I wish I could just go to bed at 1 in the afternoon and just sleep till about 7 at night. And God had given me the gift of singleness, that would have been my day, because between 9 o'clock at night and about 9 o'clock the next morning, wow. Dr. Moeller and I saw with this, there's just something about being able to get things done. Now, that's probably not your best time, but for me it is. So I write in the pastorate, even I write a blog and write other things and work on the book. I either do it late at night or early in the morning because I'm at my best. I mean that. But now that's not true for all of you. And of course, that's probably why in the afternoons I'm just completely shot. I'm just, you know, I almost have no brain in the afternoon. So write when you write best. And you, all of us are different that way. If you're stuck, 9, ask yourself if you have done enough reporting. Because chances are if you're just stuck, you need to get some more information. You've got unanswered questions, or be done. Outline your story, making sure you have all three elements listed above, and write out a nut graph. Write a couple of paragraphs and massage them. Again, put some clay on the wheel, and it will help you. And just avoid the blinking cursor. Questions about that before we go right into lead writing. These kind of go together. Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm not fully understanding the subject pronoun agreement. What should we do? What should we do?
When you modify a subject like Georgia, Georgia is an entity, it's a thing, it's an it. It should be modified by it and not they. They is a collective. It's a group of people. Like if you said Boyce College won their game. Well, Boyce College speaks of an entity, and so an entity is an it. I just see this all the time, and it's very, you know, it's very subtle. But I corrected this a lot because I did it in my first couple of stories, and my editor screamed bloody murder, and so I just remember him screaming, the one who I played the joke on, who had a foul temper. And so I remember him screaming at me about subject pronoun. He was preaching that, and it's a very common pitfall. So you have to be careful. And now I think... the good news is I started on an old Haztec machine, which didn't have any. It was kind of like a slate with a, you know, we were writing with a chalk on it. That was kind of what my first computer was. But now I think I'm almost certain that Microsoft Word will point that out. Subject word agreement. If you're underlined, it's not misspelled. Or if it's underlined green, maybe, or whichever version, the 2010 version, it will underline that. And so you'll say, subject pronoun agreement. It may even tell you. That's not fair. I had to learn all this stuff so I could preach to you guys about it. You just have. And I get the benefit of using the same programs too. So, Steve.
You're talking about the critics of Strunk and White. It seems like one of those is Stanley Fish and his How to Write a Sentence.
Yep.
And his point is that we've been trained from Strunk and White to only write short, crisp sentences, but that there's actually an art of building nice, good, long sentences.
Yeah.
But who's qualified to write nice, big, long sentences? I mean, should we just skip that and stay focused on the short?
No, I mean, I think it's fine as long as it's a well-crafted, lengthy sentence. I mean, Ephesians 1, nice, crafted. But again, we're not the Apostle Paul, but and I'm not saying we have to be to write a nice, crisp sentence. But I think nice, short, crisp sentences ought to be the general rule. I mean, not be legalistic about this, but I mean, I think you should say, I like a good rhythm. One of my friends in the PR office who wrote for us a few years ago, one of the critiques I had him early on was every sentence was the same length. It was about 11 words, and it was like me talking like this. How are you today? I'm great. How about you? What are you doing tonight? How's your family? I mean, after a while, you'd kind of go, boy, that's just kind of robotic. What's that? We've been over the politics already, but I mean, it was, they're all like that. So I think you should vary your sentence. Like, that's actually one of the tips I think I have somewhere in here. I'm with Stanley Fish a little bit. I don't think it's either or. I think you can write a nice crib, but I think it'll be peppered with short and some that are longer. Some compound sentences with two subjects and more, or two subjects, usually not more than that. But I don't have a problem with that. I wouldn't take either side there. I think he's right, but I don't think it's Strunk and White's fault. I mean, I think, we the newspaper business, we had to write short because we had such tight spatial requirements. I couldn't write, all my editors would edit away those things. Now, in this book on Calvin, I can vary the sentence length. I've got a lot more room, and I think I do that. I do try to make it more rhythmic and more pleasurable to the ears, because I will read things out loud and see how they sound. If they sound really choppy, then I try to change it up and I massage it some more and rewrite some of it. This shouldn't be all choppy. I agree. It shouldn't just be. I mean, literally, this friend, he'd write a paper and he'd have two pages, and if there were 46 sentences, the average would be, I mean, about 10 or 11 words, and everything read like that. And I said, you don't really talk that way, do you? Or you talk like this to me. It should be like a conversation. And he saw that. He said, yeah, you're right. And we'll laugh about that today. But he was just beginning to learn how to write. So I think that's part of that's why newspaper people love Strunk and White, and I'm a newspaper person. But it's not the gospel. I obviously don't agree with my first editor. But I think it's very helpful just as an accessible style manual to help you. You know, it's got a glossary of terms in there, modifiers and pronouns and participial phrases. And if you're learning Greek here, you'll know all this. You'll know English a lot better when you come out of Greek here. But I think it's just helpful for that. So they're not infallible. But I think Stanley Fish... I mean, I think he's right in terms of crafting a good, longer, more lengthy, well-flowing, beautifully written sentence. So it doesn't have to be either one. I think we should have both. That's a good question, though. I just saw an article about him, maybe Justin Taylor's blog yesterday, about Stanley Fish and Sutton, yeah, or yet day before yesterday, about that particular issue. I didn't read it all, obviously. I can't remember what it was about. I just read so much in the... I mean, here's Dr. Moeller. I mean, he remembers all of what he reads, and I'm like, yeah, I don't... It's kind of a blur after a day or two. Yes, sir.
You triggered a thought there. Do you read yours out loud sometimes?
I read mine out loud a lot, yeah. Almost all the time. I always have.
Kind of untangles it, doesn't it?
It does.
It takes away from that choppiness or verbosity.
That's right. My manuscript, my sermons, and I write them the way I would normally write them, because I think I've always written for the ear. I've just always kind of done that because I was taught that in journalism school. I mean, I've taught some really good things in journalism school, and that was one of them, that you write conversationally and write for the ear. That's why choppiness should be avoided, because it's not the way we talk. I mean, I talk in run-on sentences on and on and on. I can do that with the best of them, but so I try to make it conversational. So, yeah. Other questions before we moved into leads? Yes, sir. Yeah.
In the sense that it's probably good to have people able to recognize how you like to write, or to know in yourself. How do you sort of recognize your voice as you're learning to write better? Since there's always principles.
Sure.
That's
a great question. I'm actually going to deal with that very question. So I'll save it. I've actually got a section on your voice in here, because it's in this. That's why I recommend this book. Because the best chapter in here is on finding your voice. And we'll get to that. And I'll start the conversation this way, and then we'll pick it back up. But just being yourself, I can pick out Russ Moore's stuff, because he always writes about country music. But I can pick it up if he's not writing about that, just because, or Carl Truman. I could pick it out of a crowd. Because I hear Russ Moore talking, because I know Russ is a friend of mine, so I hear him. in his, I mean, it should, I think it should be peculiar to your personality. Take all these rules, and they should be, they're not a straitjacket. They're just principles that you, you know, kind of like the biblical authors. All the books don't read the same. There's different styles. I mean, Hebrews to me reads a lot like Paul. Sounds very Pauline. I don't know if he's the author. I'm not saying that. I don't know. But I mean, it reads that way. And so I'll read it. I think, wow, this sounds a lot like Paul. And then John's very different than Luke. So I think you should. But anyway, we'll get to that. But no, that's a great question. I think that takes a, I think that in most cases takes years to develop. I think I've just, in the last 10 years, been able to distinguish my writing from other things. I couldn't at first. But I was encouraged the first day I started a newspaper. You want to find your voice. I mean, they said, you've got gifts in this area. But I want, and my, our writing coach said, I want to cultivate that until you're able to write. And I would recognize your writing over here when you're, you know, 30 years old. I was an 18-year-old kid. So we'll get to that. That's a great question. Lead writing. I said earlier that perhaps the single most important paragraph of your story, or I mean anything you write, is getting off to a good start. Even in an academic paper, you know, there's nothing worse than in reading. I've read, you know, I taught adjunctively. I taught at Boyce College. I've taught over here. Nothing worse for me and get me in a worse mood and on the path to grading this thing pretty strictly than a really bad beginning. It confuses me from the outset. It's unclear from the outset. It isn't good from the outset. And maybe it gets better, but I mean, you want to get off to a good start. And it's certainly important in newspapers or in any kind of short essay type, more type writing. We may do some exercises. I've got that on there. We'll see if we have time. But within your lead, you'll either draw the reader in or you will repel them. I mean, I read the North Georgia News for, you know, probably sinful amusement at this point, but just, you know, say this is horrible and see how many Latin terms are in the leads. But I mean, I would not read that. I mean, I wouldn't read any further. I'd say this is confusing. This guy's confused and I'm not going to be confused any further. And I'm moving on to something like four slugs in the back. Now I'm going to read that. Oh, this guy got slugs in the back. I'm going to read that because I want to know, is this a joke or is this about some guy got shot in the back? Well, I want to read about that. I really would read that. Or, like I said, if you quote, you know, Dolly Parton lyrics like Russ Moore often does, I want to read that because I want to see how you're talking about the problem of evil and how you've introduced, you know, George Jones or something. I want to know how you tie those together. And Carl Truman and Russ Moore and people like that, others like that, can tie those things. C.S. Lewis was good at irony, tying things in the culture together with theology and ethics. And you will be equipped when you come out of this place to do that as well. I think Southern Seminary does that better than anyone in the world, in my opinion. But the problem is you're probably accustomed to writing essays or thesis papers for your high school composition plans classes, and what do they begin with? A topic sentence. Today, I will write about nuclear disarmament. Okay, it's a topic sentence. Now, my son is learning how to write. He's in fourth grade at classical school, and that's what he writes. And that's good for a fourth grader. Okay, he's doing, if he can give me a crisp topic sentence, I'm very, very happy. And he's gotten pretty good at that. But, you know, later I'm going to say, forget that, and let's write something better. But you have to run before you can, or you have to walk before you can run. And that is great for an English essay, but not acceptable for a news story, and usually not acceptable for anything you're going to write here at Southern Seminary, or you're going to write that's going to be read by a broader audience after you leave here. Journalistic writing, or kind of this popular type writing, is completely different. I mean, a lead sets the tone or the mood for the rest of the story, so choose your lead carefully. Choose your words carefully. I mean, depending on what you're writing about, there may be certain leads that are more appropriate than others. Again, this editor that I've shown you this morning wrote a very flippant lead about someone getting killed in a car accident. And boy, I mean, it made me angry. And I thought, that's unacceptable. Because it said the guy is not from around here. That's what it was. As if it's a good thing he's not one of our people. He's dead and we don't really care. That's what it said. It said, a guy was killed in a car wreck, but he's not from around here. Wow, we're thankful for that. I mean, there was a lawsuit against the paper. I don't know what happened, but boy, that's not very smart. I don't think it was Norman. I think it was somebody else. So we're going to say it is to protect the guilty. But if none of here's just some examples or types of leads. And now, if these don't work, I mean, come up with your own approach. I mean, I've had students here, I've had writers here write leads that wouldn't fit into any of these categories, but were quite good. You kind of know it when you see it, because you all have different personalities. Again, we're not trying to use this to put you into a box. We're trying to give you some principles, some principles. They'll make your writing good and sound and clear, and yet you'll have significant freedom given your own personality, given your abilities, given your background, what you're studying. I mean, theology or philosophy or, you know, history, whatever it is you're writing, you'll bring all that to bear in your writing. And the more you know, the better writer you're going to be. The more you read, the better writer you're going to be, because you'll know more and be able to say more. But the first one's a summary lead, and this is the most traditional lead in journalistic article. This is typically a 5W lead: who, what, when, where, and why, how, and an H summarizes. Here's an example. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan told Congress yesterday that U.S. economic growth appeared to be slowing, heading off for the moment any need to raise interest rates. Wall Street responded with a cheer, sending stocks and bonds soaring. But that's hard news. There's not many good ways. That's a good way to say that. I mean, you don't want to say, you know, you don't want to go out and find someone who's cheering and write about them cheering. Just say that in a story about the Federal Reserve. That's good. And it's usually breaking news, a first day lead. You'd see this if, you know, there were a murder last night. You'd see this in the paper the next day. Or the first person to write about this. 9/11, where there were hard top summary type leads about, you know, these buildings were bombed, not sure who it is, and then come back and have different leads on different stories to follow up in the days after that. Single item lead: this lead focuses on just one or two elements in a story. A summary lead for a bigger punch. Just for instance, when the Philadelphia Phillies won the 2008 World Series, their first championship since 1980, a story posted online by the AP began with this single item lead: the Philadelphia Phillies are world champions again. Well, that's not bad. Not bad at all. And then you come back and say they've not won since 1980, only once in their history, second time in their history, whatever. As opposed to a typical summary lead, the Philadelphia Phillies will enter their long wait for a World Series title with a short burst of baseball last night as they clinched the crown by completing a rain-suspended 4-3 win over the Tampa Bay Rays. Those are just two different approaches to the same story. A delayed identification lead, or blind lead. This is when you kind of wanted to introduce, kind of save the punchline. You don't always want to be to clearly identify the subject, or if it's the subject's going to make it really long. Like Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan said, you know, you may want to put that in the second paragraph instead of, you know, so it won't make your lead 45 or 50 or 60 words long. You're missing a page?
It starts on the back.
Oh, it's on the page. Flip over. Should be front and back? Yeah. Front and back? No? It's not that way in mine. So.
On the back of the 7, I have 10, 11, and 12.
Yeah, but it's on the, yeah, we're missing those, but it continues the rest of 3 to get on the ground. That's the delayed identification.
Oh, okay. Delayed identification goes before 10, that's what you think?
He does the title for 3.
I don't know. I'm in the dark. I've got the right thing here. You guys, I've got the... I've got the original manuscript here, so you guys are, you guys just have copies.
So what is your first line after the lead?
Sometimes with summary leads.
Nope, that's not it.
Okay. Well, you guys are going to take my word for it. All right? You don't have this at all?
Seven?
Okay. I'm sorry. We'll try to get this out to you. All right. Well, like I said, I've got the original manuscripts. I've got the word. So we'll continue. We'll press on here. Okay. Let's go to the fourth one. We kind of lost ourselves here. We'll make sure and get this to you. Maybe we can send this out or something to, I don't know. We'll figure out a way to get this valuable information to you. Okay. The fourth kind of lead, creative lead. I love these leads because you get to be creative, right? This is crucial with online blog type writing, where you're not writing a hard, you don't write a lot of hard news leads, especially for a blog, unless it's something somebody else, no one else knows. You have unique information. I mean, unless you're writing hard news for a daily paper or regularly updated website, the summary lead just doesn't reel in readers typically, because they've learned this somewhere else. Yes, sir. No. A lead is the first paragraph of a story. It's the first sentence you'll write in a story or a paper. We call them leads in newspapers. Like this Take USA Today. Let's look here on the front page. Hiring for holiday season, expect to be ho-hum. That's the story. the lead is retailers are already decking their halls with holiday decor. That's not good. But workers who want seasonal jobs should keep their cheer in check. Hiring will be tepid. New surveys show. That's the lead. That's the first paragraph. Are you drawn in by that?
Cliche.
That's right. Yeah, I went, duh. I gave it the kind of the Kramer reaction there. Because they usually don't do this. They taught me this, and now they're going back on there. I mean, to some degree, they taught me. Not the first part. The Christian worldview stuff. They taught me how to write a lead. So retailers are decking their halls with holiday decor, but workers who want seasonal jobs should keep their cheer in check. Hiring will be tepid, new survey show. Okay, I've seen worse. I've read worse today, haven't I? So anyway, creative lead with flair. That's the lead. That's the first paragraph. That's what I'm speaking of. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear about that. But again, this is crucial with blog type writing, I think. I mean, something flair. And I think that attempts to have flair there, actually. Probably a creative lead. Here's an example. A late spring snowstorm surprised forecasters today. Forecasters and drivers Tuesday afternoon, triggering more than 30 accidents, Cleveland police officials said. You wouldn't want to say that. You might take a more creative approach. You might go out and, you know, get in the snow and talk to someone who drove in it or something like that. I don't know. You could try something with more a bit more creative lead, especially if it's a feature story. You always want to, you know, it's to paint a picture, and we'll get to sort of a different kind of lead there. Short sentence lead. This lead uses one word or short phrase as a teaser for the rest of the lead, and this should be rare. Readers may find this gimmicky, so use it sparingly. Here's an example. 1/5 of an inch, period, paragraph. That's all the snow it took to trigger more than 30 accidents on local roads yesterday as a late spring snowstorm snuck up on Cleveland motorists. That's not bad. That's not bad because that shows that they don't know how to drive in snow, like the people in my hometown, because we don't get much snow. So 1/5 of an inch, period. It's a journalist.
We discussed that, as what's a sentence and what's not. And with that, not, you said rarely, but is it appropriate or not?
I think it's appropriate. I mean, yeah, since I've used leads like that before, it's definitely appropriate. There's no question about that. But I think, that's kind of a standard journalistic practice. Don't ask me where we got it. But I mean, the shortest verse in the Bible has a subject and a verb, doesn't it? Jesus wept, so I guess you can't go to the Bible to back that up like we like to. But, that's extent. That is standard journalistic practice to have a word or just a short sentence like that doesn't. I mean, Kevin DeYoung writes that way sometimes. I like it. I don't mind it. Again, the whole story shouldn't be sprinkled with non-sentences like that without a subject and a verb. So it's okay. I'm giving you permission here, so... Is he giving you a hard time about that? Yeah, okay, you art guys and writers have to try to get along. Find some middle ground here. This is the middle ground. I'm the peacemaker here, right? You're trying to read without being silly. I mean, sometimes, like the who, what, when, where, why, just answer those questions. Don't ask me that. You know, that was good. This is not bad, though. I got that from the Cleveland newspaper somewhere. Okay, so that's a short sentence lead, an analogy lead. This lead makes a comparison between an issue or event you're writing about, something that's more familiar to the average reader. And this is when you're dealing with some kind of a complex issue, you know, some foreign matter that's foreign to your readers that you want to explain in layman's terms, like a SPLOST, special local option sales tax. Make a comparison. You know, how much it's going to cost them or something like that. Here's an example. The Netherlands is considering anti-terrorism laws that make the United States Patriot Act look like a civil libertarian's dream come true. So they're very strict. These are going to be very strict anti-terrorism laws that are much more strict than America's civil anti-terrorism laws. So something like that. I found that. Yeah, I'm not sure I like what that communicates, but that's an example of the lead. A wordplay lead is another. This is number 7, so you may be able to rejoin me here, right? Okay, good. Very good. I feel better now. This lead includes a clever turn of a phrase or a name or a word. And you got to be careful using this lead because it can mislead the reader. The reader may think your story is about one thing, then discover it's about something else and get annoyed. So you don't want to annoy your reader. I think a wordplay lead approach works for this. I have an example here of a story about a fire at a costume store. And I got this from something about leads. And Paul Tuckett wrote down, Bill Clinton will finally get taken to the cleaners. So will Dracula and a Playboy bunny. They're things that typically we think of as being dirty and needing cleaned, right? So that's the wordplay lead. The three are among some 6,000 smoke-damaged costumes that will visit dry cleaners in the next few days because of a fire that broke out Wednesday night at Morris Novelty, a popular costume and novelty store. So that's not bad. That's not silly. Again, I think maybe the three slugs or four slugs in the back, that's kind of a word play because you're using that gangster language without. I don't think that's silly. I mean, I think that's warranted. But you have to be careful because it can come across as somewhat silly. The scenic lead, that's painting a picture. And when I would do, have to go out, I'd have to go cover festivals in North Georgia sometimes, and I'd try to paint a scene about the fall leaves or something like that. And I don't remember any lead that I did, but a description of a scene surrounding an event. This is typically used in a story in which the setting itself is somewhat prominent. It usually will strike an appropriate mood for the story, and I have an example there. I won't read it to you guys can read. So a storytelling lead, this is narrative style, introduces the main characters, the conflict, the setting of the story. Wall Street Journal uses this a lot. I like this a lot. They will introduce the character, I mean, kind of tell a story. Those kind of things draw me into the story. I remember one of the best stories, I've lost this, I can't find it online. One of the best stories I've ever read in the Wall Street Journal, they used to have, and I think it's the fourth column over, below the fold, they have a daily feature story. That's right, bottom middle. And it's written by a reporter who spent usually a month or two on that story only. And so it's going to be a great story. And this reporter had gone to Paris Island and gone through basic with the Marines once to talk about how rigorous Marine Corps training was. And it was wonderful. I loved it. I don't remember the lead, but I remember how he painted a picture of what a Marine might face on the battlefield. And it was him, actually his story. And it was good. I remember I had that story for years, and one of my moves, we lost it somewhere in my good stuff file. But it's very good. And I remember the lead just painted a picture, and I couldn't. It was one of those stories, maybe I wouldn't have, I would have normally read it because I like things like that, warfare, you know, I'm a guy and all that stuff. But I really found it compelling. And sometimes I'll read stories that begin with a storytelling lead that I really wouldn't usually read, but they've drawn me into it now, and I'm kind of committed. I want to know what they're going to tell me. I like that using a narrative style. I used to try to use that. I used that a lot when I was a reporter because I just like that myself. Here, Wall Street Journal reporter Angelo Henderson used this approach to begin his Pulitzer Prize-winning article about a pharmacist who is driven to violence by encounters with armed robbery. And I love this. "Get on the ground," a man holding a gun screamed. "I'll blow your head off if you move." Well, there's a quote, you know, talking about a quote lead. I'm going to move on. I'm going to read that because I want to know who's going to get their heads blown off here. I mean, it's going to be me, or what's going to happen here? Dennis Greel and a co-worker complied. Dreamlike, he found himself lying face down on a cold, gritty black tile floor. Those are good details. A pistol against the back of his head. I mean, you can almost feel it. You're like, boy, I could feel the cold, you know, of the barrel of this Smith & Wesson to the back of my head. You know, I want to read on. "Please, mister, don't make me shoot you," a second gunman threatened. A crazy memory. Tiny specks of lighting floating in the tile. That and the paralyzing weight of helplessness. Mr. Grill is a pharmacist, unassuming, mild-mannered, a family man with a wife and daughter. He was being robbed. That's a good lead. I mean, I'm going to read on. I'll read a lot of that story to find out. Nowadays, I'll skim a lot of the story, but you know, back when I was in newspapers, I would always read that. So that's a good example of a narrative lead. An amazing fact lead. Open with an amazing fact that arouses readers' interests. And here's this one, 60% of Americans oppose the U.S. war in Iraq, the highest number since the poem began, and you read that. Or something like, you know, a politician being honest. I mean, something that's humorous, but wow, it's kind of startling. And something that really startles, or amazing fact lead. Startling statement lead, very similar to an amazing fact lead. And these are leads I was taught in journalism school. Open with a startling statement that arouses reader interest. And you have Lincoln, Rhode Island. The first thing Elizabeth Moon sees in the morning is her room where her father was beaten to death. And I think Russ Moore is really good at using shocking. He'll say shocking things sometimes. And boy, I'll listen. I'm like, wow, I want to read on here. He does that in his sermon sometimes. Or it's not all, I mean, I like that. So that's shocking. It was 1 year ago yesterday that she and this bucolic town were stunned by the brutal and still unsolved murder of Dr. Alfred C. Moon. The radiologist's naked body was found in his bed, bludgeoned with a lamp. It's a good story. See, and you see how in the details it's not general. It's very specific. And the same with the Wall Street Journal story about that won the Pulitzer Prize. He says, this bucolic town, brutal. So, okay, the radiologist's naked body was found in his bed, bludgeoned with a lamp. I mean, that's specific. Boy, that really puts you there, doesn't it? It makes you feel kind of uneasy. And I've done that before, trying to make my... I did a one of my favorite series of stories I ever did. I spent the weekend with a paramilitary group once, an anti-government paramilitary group, not sympathizing with them, but I was there. They let me, since I was conservative, but I wasn't conservative enough for them, thankfully, they let me come and spend the weekend at one of their boot camps. And so I did a three-part series and actually won an award in the North Carolina Press Association on that. And so I wrote leads like this about them. And one of the leads was, I don't remember now, it was shocking. And it was about, it was basically a lead about what they said they would do if a local sheriff's deputy were to show up on their property. And so, I mean, we had this checked out by our attorneys read all the, they read my stories. I had to sign that I wouldn't, if I was killed, that I wouldn't sue the newspaper because they said, look, they wanted someone to come and do one for years, but I was stupid enough or brave enough or whatever I was. I was single and 24. I went and did it. I don't think I'd do it now, but they were crazy. Well, yeah, the newspaper company I worked for would not, they were afraid of these people, and rightly so. They were vicious people. But they were a presence in this town, and they had kept the local population just terrorized for years. The people were scared to death of them. So they were very clandestine. They'd have all these weekend warrior things up on top of the mountain at their fortress. They had a fort built up there, and I mean, it had turrets and all this stuff, and no one ever understood them. So I decided, again, I was 24. I didn't have a family. I've got minimal risk here. I'll go. I can shoot a gun. I'll go out there and hang out with these people and you know, and see what they're all about. And I was conservative. Their leader sort of liked me. He didn't like me too much, thankfully. He's one of those people, if he'd have liked you, I'd have been concerned about my own worldview, you know. And so I went out there and I spent the whole weekend with them. And I was scared. I came back. I'm like, you people aren't scared enough. You're not nearly scared. You have no idea what they're talking about up there. It's not what they're doing. It's what they're talking about. So anyway, it was, and so I did a three-part series on that, I mean, ran like a month later because our, you know, even our attorneys were very, and I was seen as a bit of a, you know, a swashbuckler for doing this. But again, 24 and single, and I enjoyed it. And that was probably my favorite story of anything I've ever done. That was probably my favorite because there was some risk, and you know, 24 and not a lot of responsibilities, and so I did enjoy that. And yeah, I wrote these kind of leads, and one of them was really outrageous about as the threats. Because I said, what would you do? What will you do if law enforcement shows up here to execute a search warrant for it? And they told me. They would open fire. They would go to war with the... Because they said, well, we know that's when the war starts. And it ran that way. And so, yeah, I think that's why I got the award. Our company, they said, well, if you were stupid, I mean, brave enough to do it, we're going to run the stories like this. And so they did. They ran the stories largely as I wrote them. And our president, company president, he was a newspaper guy, and he edited them some, but not a lot. But my lead was, the lead to one of the stories was very shocking. It was about that. And we even let the sheriff read it. He thought it was funny. He was just an older guy. He didn't care. I bet he wasn't going to go up there, though. He didn't go near their, he even wouldn't drive past their property probably anymore. I wouldn't if these people were, they were crazy. But that was the whole point. I mean, my story showed, I hope, that they have a complaint. I think it's a legitimate complaint, but their solution is just completely wrong-headed. I mean, it's crazy. They're going to go to war with the government. And unfortunately, it was in the name of Christ. They were Christians. They told me that the book of Revelation had been inserted in the Bible by the government to confuse us and to take our mind off of the war, the coming war. I mean, they were just out. They had a theology class and a theologian who actually was their theologian, and they had a Bible class. And I sat in on the Bible class, and that was the scariest thing I saw all weekend. It was, boy, forget the guns. It's their interpretation of the Bible, twisting of Scripture. So anyway, so I got a chance to have a startling statement in my lead, or maybe all three parts, I don't know.
One year ago yesterday, that she and this bucolic town were stunned by the brutal and still unsolved murder. That word brutal, would that be color into it? Would that be more telling than showing?
Yeah. And I mean, if you have, you know, only say 400 words to write a story, you'll have to do some of that. I mean, I have to say brutal instead of showing how brutal, you know, there was blood everywhere and there was, you know, intestine, you know, just want to, but I mean, you show, wow, that was brutal. But yeah, that is more of a telling. And you'll do some of that. But overall, you want to show the brutality if you can without, I mean, in good taste. You don't want to just,
yeah. So it is more
That's right. Like a car. That's right. It is. That is a bit of telling. You're right. Yeah. Cormac McCarthy novel here or something. Oh, yeah. That's right. No, I mean, these are all used for different, I mean, it's kind of like a different lead for a different occasion. I mean, I used all kinds of different leads, and I mean, some that didn't fit in any of these categories. As I matured as a writer, I was able to make, you know, sort of a blended storytelling, shocking, amazing fact lead, you know, some of those things are maybe crossed. These aren't hard, fast categories. They're just some things that give you some help in starting. Like I could use I've got an amazing fact in here that would shock people but tell something about that would summarize the story too. Like, I can't think of an example of what I did here, but yeah. So these aren't hard, fast. No, yeah, don't take these as you need to adopt one of these styles, but these are just lots of different ways and these aren't even, this isn't exhaustive. These are just 13 ways, a baker's dozen, as I'd say, just to start a news story or even I would write some of my academic papers here. I would start with kind of an illustration to illustrate my thesis and say, this is an illustration of the thesis. And my professors here at least always seem to like that. So, and but I took that from my news writing. I mean, it helped me in that way. So that's that. Yeah, I want to be clear about that. Good question. Opposite lead. Start first one point of view of observation, then follow the opposite view. And again, you won't maybe do this as much in Christian journalism, but you it could be helpful. Facebook rots the brain, according to a report by a Stansbury University psychology professor. Jim Wallace, honor student and an avid user of the popular website, says it just isn't true. So you're going to go on to go this sort of competing versions of whether or not views of Facebook. The list lead. Now, and sometimes instead of focusing on just one person, place, or thing, you want to impress the reader with a longer list. I mean this in a good way. Here's an example from the Arizona Republic, the growing popularity of general aviation in Phoenix. Whenever sixth grader Vassil Ivanov has a day off from school, he hops into a Cessna 152 and takes to the skies. On weekends, Sue Sumner likes to fly her grandson around the valley just to see the sights. There's a special restaurant that funeral director Lincoln Ragsdale Jr. likes to visit for breakfast, but it's 115 miles away from home. He climbs into his Beach Bonanza A36, and an hour later, he's eating pancakes in Sedona. Ivanov, Sumner, and Ragsdale are among the growing numbers of Arizonans piloting small airplanes. That's pretty good. It kind of tells you, kind of paints a picture. I've used those kinds of leads before. So those are some ways to start a story. Again, that'll get you to thinking, too. I found just having some of these categories, you look through your research or your notebook of things of notes you've taken or the interviews you've done, and you just think, what's a good way to start? I can start it this way or this way. It just gives you some categories. Again, they're not hard and fast. These aren't the only ones. They just kind of give you some help, some tools kind of in your box to start. Aaron. Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah. That's right. Absolutely. I mean, there's some of these that should be rare. I mean, I don't, you know, I don't know if I ever used, I never came up with a lot of amazing facts, I don't think, in my journalism. I wouldn't want to use an unamazing fact as an amazing fact, and the reader would be like, really underwhelmed. Why is he saying this, you know? Hey, the sky is really blue today. Well, thanks a lot for telling us that. So, yeah, some of these ought to be rare. I mean, I always opted for the kind of a general. Yeah, I mean, I'd try to hit a single rather than, again, trying to my friend who would walk the halls trying to get illumination for a lead. So just, okay, I'm going to hit a single here. Home runs are rare. And so, no, that's right. Some of them would be home runs. So that's good. And that leads a perfect segue into types of leads to avoid. Don't begin with a quotation. I've written hundreds of stories in my career. I use a quotation twice. Two times, period. Now, you'll find three stories of mine here at campus where I used a quotation lead probably. But as far as I know, I used two. And one was I interviewed a tornado victim, a woman who had been picked up in her house. Her house was 3,000 square feet. It was all picked up off the ground with her in it and was moved about, I think it was 1,000 yards and sat down on its top. And she survived to tell about it. And so her quote, I forgot what the quote, it was great. But I had to set the context. I'd be really, really careful. I mean, but seldom is a quote so interesting that it's not that's worth beginning your story with. And it's hard to provide the context. Again, I used one from the North Georgia News about sewage rate, whatever it was, whatever you and I talked about that. But I mean, it just doesn't provide the context. So it's because let's go back to that. You don't want to keep beating a dead horse here. Someone have the... Oh, here we go. So, okay, this story about wastewater treatment facility. This is what everybody's been waiting to hear, said Ken Smith, wastewater treatment plant operator for the city of Blairville, when he gave his report to the mayor and city council. Well, there's no antecedent to this, the pronoun, this demonstrative pronoun. It's supposed to be a near demonstrative. A near demonstrative is alluding to information that is near to that sentence. This is what everybody has been waiting for. What is this? And what kind of report is he giving the mayor and the council, and why should we care? This doesn't answer those questions. So it's hard. Now, if he'd included all the context, it'd probably been about 100 words. So it's better just to save that quote and say, we're getting a new wastewater treatment plant, and it's going to save everybody $50 on their water bill each month. And then say, this is what everybody's been waiting for. We're in a financial tie here. Good. That's the better way to proceed, not with a quote. Editors usually hate these, and they're confused by it because it just kind of jumps into the context. You know, it's like people use the Bible to prove anything. They sort of jump in and say, well, you know, God is love. Well, it says a lot of other stuff about God and love and all the other stuff. It's kind of like that to me. So be careful about using with a quotation. Questions. Now, I think even, yes, sir. I guess. I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, even wastewater treatment plant operator. I mean, this is the guy, that, you know, I mean, all respect to the wastewater. I mean, this is a guy who's not really an official. He's just glad that whatever they're going to do, they've done. It just doesn't tell anything, I don't think. But it might be a good quote for later on to say, we've been waiting for this for a long time. It's going to be cleaner. I work in here and I get nasty every day. I don't know what he's talking about. Wastewater is nasty. I don't know. I mean, it's going to save us money. I just don't know what the story's about. Although, wastewater's treatment facility for cities switching over a new system, how's the new system going to be benefit? Why do we care? I mean, if it's a gravity-based system or an electric flow system, I could care less. I mean, if you're I'm not going to read a story about that because it doesn't save me money or doesn't, you know, I don't know. If it doesn't do something important, then I don't think you should write a story about it. I wouldn't have written this story, I don't think, if I were working for this newspaper or the editor. I would have said, nah, probably, I mean, great. They're going to gravity, so whatever it is. I mean, I'm speculating about what it is. But questions. Now I'm going to make an exception about questions. And in theological education, and some writing here, we answer a lot of important questions. So I think it's okay if you're writing about some, you know, I've done this with regard to theology, you know, about what is the relationship between God's sovereignty and man's responsibility. Well, the New Southern Baptist Journal of Theology deals with that. Well, that's what it's about. A question. That's okay. I've done that on occasion here, but typically you're there to provide information. You're there to answer questions and not ask them. So you really need to ask the question. That makes sense. So you kind of want to make that rare. Again, it's not heresy to use one of these as a, you know, because I've used them all, even a quotation. And like I said, twice in my career, and I think as far as I can remember, to avoid statements like picture this or imagine this. Well, the reader can. He wasn't there. I mean, you're supposed to paint the picture for him. Don't say, picture this. Well, you tell me. I wasn't there. It's like saying, you know. Well, no, I don't know. Tell me. Do you want me to finish the conversation with you? I used to have a habit of saying that when I was in the PhD program, and Dr. Nettles said, you say you know all the time. And it makes me want to say, and he's a very nice man, like a father to me, so he could say, do you want me to finish your conversation for you? Is that gives me that feeling? So it helped me to stop saying, you know. But it's just like that. It's like saying, you know. It's kind of a journalistic version of, you know, picture this or imagine this. Well, just paint the picture. Don't make them think about what it is they should imagine. So rarely use that. I mean, I think it's implied in the reading of your article. Again, show but don't tell. Topical. Avoid at all costs in the same way you'd write a topic sentence for an English essay. Just don't do it. Those are never good. And I found some examples here. The faculty at Southern Seminary convened, I plugged in Southern, so none of us wrote this. The faculty at Southern Seminary convened a meeting last night to discuss curriculum. Well, meetings are never news. The fact that meetings happen all the time, that's news. And boy, we'll just have the meeting gazette. And discussing curriculum, no, yeah, that's just not much of a home run with me either, anybody. So just, don't start that. We'll say, Southern Seminary has embraced biblical counseling as its new way forward. Well, now that's big news. That's a big difference. And, I remember when we did stories on that a few years ago. Now that was brand new. The whole department was changing. We want to talk about that curriculum, but we had that in the lead, not they met and they considered new curriculum. Or the University of Georgia battled Florida in a crucial football game on Saturday. Okay. And those actually appeared in the newspapers, and I've got the NGN. Won't look at that again. But avoid stating the obvious. Something like, this election is expected to be one of the most important in history. Well, they always say it about every election. I mean, I've heard that about every election I can remember. And I've been around for more elections than most of you guys, but they are all important because they're all historical, right? All elections are. And be concise. Avoid wordiness. Never use a dictionary definition. Boy, that's a huge pet peeve of mine. Webster's defines, that's lazy. You didn't think much about that one. You just said, look at the dictionary. Or now it's type in the dictionary. There it is. Cut and paste it in. No, don't do that. When leads. Unless the time something occurred is by far the most important fact, and it seldom is. Too many stories start with a dull account of time such as this year or on November 7th. We should have the time element buried in there somewhere. That shouldn't be what you start with in your lead. You see my no and yes there. And why is this important? Well, here's why it's important. The lead sets the tone or the mood for what's to follow. Is it going to be tragic, cold, humorous? I mean, if you choose the wrong tone for the story, it can be lethal. But also bias creeps in with what you lead with. This is where we find bias in the newspaper every single day. And here's an example. Scenario. City officials decide to install new parking meters. Okay, let's say that's the subject. What are you going to write about? Well, a journalist could lead a story by discussing how community members voiced their opposition to this, calling it slimy and greedy. But on the other hand, a journalist could lead with, to avoid a budget deficit without raising taxes, city officials will install parking meters. The first is negative and skeptical. The second is more pro-government. So you see how just very subtly you've changed the whole tone of that article. And reporters will do this all the time, especially in sort of broad-brushing conservatives. Or, they'll always choose the... paint the conservatives in the worst possible light or use the most snarky comment from the conservative. And one of my favorite examples of this was when there was a tornado in the mountains where I'm from. They'd always come and they'd find, like Jed Clampett out there and talk to him, and he'd be like, it sounded like a tornado, and they, and like these poor people, they were hit. They're already, rednecks, and that's bad enough, but now they've been hit with a tornado, and so now they're rednecks, the trailer's been blown away by a tornado. We just ought to feel sorry for these poor, innocent rubes. They really communicated that. I really think they worked to find. There are no bankers or businessmen in this town or school teachers or pastors. There's just a lot of people like this guy. And that poor guy, this is 15 minutes of fame. He was excited about being on there and talking about the locomotive that blew through here. But it always painted a very unsavory picture of my hometown, which there's enough truth in that, I know. But man, so people would say when I went to the University of Georgia, my roommate would always tell his friends who were much more enlightened than I was. He was a bit of a liberal. So he's from Blairsville, and they would wink. And so he's the guy on television with the locomotive coming through, swiping the trailer, off its footing. So they always do that. I mean, it's about every time. I remember they had a snow story from my hometown. It doesn't snow up there much, and they found the most toothless person they could find, and they said, Blairsville, Georgia, top of the mountains. And it's like, man, we don't get much snow around here. And I thought, they didn't go down into town. Just go find somebody else. My goodness. Talk to the football coach. Talk to somebody else. They got that same person, and they may be lying. He may not really be from Blairsville. I always tell people that. Can't trust the media, because that guy wasn't from Blairsville. Anyway. So this is where really bias of all kinds creeps in, class bias or conservative liberal bias. It's in the choosing of the facts. What do you choose to highlight? Again, this gets back to showing versus telling. With a biblical worldview, I want to show the effects of the gospel. I want to show what because the gospel is the power of God unto salvation. It's the change agent par excellence, and so we want to be about that. So we are biased. But let's choose things that make, that make the gospel, make God glorified, that make the gospel look good. And so we come as biased, very much so. I mean, just in a very basic, when writing a lead, is this lead interesting? Will the reader find it interesting enough to continue on? And usually don't settle for the first lead you come up with. Try several, unless you have a fast approaching deadline, and then do the best you can. Just get on base, hit a single. I used to tell my friend, I've done that many, many, many times in my career. Questions? You're talking about headlines?
Headlines, yeah.
Yeah, boy. Headlines are usually constrained, unfortunately, by space. Even online, you don't want to have too much. I mean, too many words. You don't want to tell the whole story in a headline. But you want to have a compelling headline. And you always try to, either something really straightforward that communicates what the story is about, or something, if it's sports especially, you can have some fun with that. Like my old sports editor, who was a brilliant writer, now teaches journalism at the University of Georgia. He was the first editor I had. The guy had the anger issues. He was great at writing headlines. Like, I remember one headline he wrote about Atlanta Hawks and Phoenix Suns. We covered a game, and he wrote, "Hawks get up too late to stop Suns rise." That's a good headline. I like that. He was real clever like that. He could write clever headlines. So. You have to be careful with headlines. I mean, either make them very accurate and straightforward, or, kind of play on words, something will draw people in. I mean, it's similar to a lead. But I like headlines that tell me what the story's about, tell me what happened. Your gas bill will go up $25 this month. That's a good headline for me because I don't have to read the story. I can know, gas bill's high enough anyway, and move on like that. So it needs to be one of the two, or something compelling. And here we wrote a lot of straightforward headlines because we're writing about theology. So we try to be straightforward, but sometimes we were able to write creative headlines. Just depends on your story. But yeah, I think you do your best to draw them into the story, kind of like the lead, if you can, without being silly. I've seen silly headlines or funny headlines like man sentenced to die in violin case. That's a good one. Man sentenced to 20 years in violin case. Like, boy, he must have been a small guy, you know. Things like that. You have to be careful how you write them. Or Israeli head seeks arms. That was a good one. See, this would be a little, kind of the Adam Family hand or whatever. So, I've written the funniest one I ever saw, which one of the editors in my company wrote, and she got in trouble because she published it. Man arrested for lewd sexual behavior on top of chunky gal. She'd been waiting her whole career as a mountain called Chunky Gal, and there's a pervert who'd been arrested on. And she was about to publish the paper that day, and she came to me and another editor and said, "You think I should do this?" I said, "There is no way I would do that. I would write that, I would show it to my friends like you're doing, and then I would scrap that." And she couldn't resist, and so the next day, the lead headline in the little small town paper, and boy, it sold the papers. So, man, that was a great, I mean, it's a clever headline, but yeah, the company president who read every word we wrote was not happy with that headline. Even though it was accurate, I don't know what happened. She'd get fired, but she probably wished she'd been fired after that. So, yeah, man, arrest. I'll just never forget it. And advising her, "That's great. Let's laugh about it and change it." Cut off the last part, leave the first part. So she didn't. So some of them we ought to resist. Not silly, just, I guess, not very nice. But he was a good Southern Baptist, and he didn't like it, our company president. So, yeah. Anything else? Any other? Yes, sir.
You alluded to it briefly, but do you remember the first time you got edited and what that felt like? When they write something like this.
Yeah, boy.
And your precious words get tough.
They were precious the same way that, the same way that my children are precious and innocent. yeah, I do. I remember, and I told you the outcome of my first story was I covered a high school football game on a Sunday afternoon. This wasn't exactly, covering the legislature or going to T4G or anything. sent me out to this. It was the last assignment on the board. Nobody else wanted it. So I went out and did it. It was kind of a trial because I was competing with 12 other people for a job at a daily paper. And so, you know, so it wasn't a lot of competition, thankfully, because my story wasn't great. But I remember he took it back in those days. He printed out one of those old dot matrix printers. And I remember him looking at it. And he looked at me. Yeah, I had the lines. You know, it came up. He tore the paper off and he looked at it. So I'd ask him for critique. I was being humble, you know, so I wanted the job. And so, you know, I want to be critiqued. I'm used to that. I love that. You know, we all love critique and to be criticized. So anyway, you know, I'm 19 years old trying to get the job. And so he looks at it and I'm kind of grinning. He's not marking this at all. He's got a red pen in his hand. I think this is great. Perfect story, right? One for one. So he just wads it up from the top and did this and gritted his teeth. And I was sitting, like maybe you, across his desk and hit me with it. Like a spit wad. And so I wasn't, you know, I take it you didn't like it. And he's like, no, lead's terrible. And I don't know. I have no, thankfully, recollection of what it was. I think I used a cliche. It was bad. Something about getting up off the carpet. Oh, yeah, it was just bad, bad, bad. Shouldn't have said it. Anyway, I learned about cliches that day and with some pretty direct language. But, yeah, I mean, it never feels good, but you have to get used to it. I mean, that's the way. If you are egotistical and in love with your prose and aren't, willing to be edited, you will never make it in writing, because if you write something and send it to a publisher, they're going to edit it and they're going to be nice. I mean, Crossway, I mean, Justin Taylor's not going to send me an insulting email, but they're going to edit it. I hope they do, because if it's going out there for all the world to see, I want it to be really good. I've had some editors made me look awfully good. I had an editor once write the best lead I ever had. I had nothing to do with it. It was great. I don't remember it, but I remember thinking, that's genius. I didn't write it. But I love it. It went perfectly, that story, and I completely missed it. So we need good editors. But it does, I mean, nobody likes it. But I've met reporters. In fact, I had a reporter I had to let go once who was completely insulted, would not be edited, and I don't think he's a newspaper. I don't know what he's doing today, but he's not doing that. You just have to leave your ego. Good. It's good for your sanctification to be edited, I think. I've been edited a lot. Thankful. I'm thankful for good editors. And people can say, this is just silly. It isn't good. Don't hit me in the head with my work done. Any other questions before we take a short break? How long's our break going to be? You news guys? Oh, we're behind. We're just running behind here. Okay. You want to go ahead and go to 3? Okay. Yes. Okay. Let's do it. Well, what I want to talk about is your voice. And what I'm going to do simply is really allude to buy this book. Because what I would say to you here is in this book, William Zinsser, On Writing Well. William Zinsser, it's a classic. It's considered a classic, On Writing Well, Writing Nonfiction. Z-I-N-S-S-E-R, one N, two S's. William Zinsser. You can get this on Amazon for a song, typically. And it does not matter. I think there's a newer edition here than the one I have. Chapter 20 is worth the price of admission in my estimation. It's called The Sound of Your Voice. And really, what I would say about that is this will come as you write. I mean, write your personality. Again, Russ Moore... Carl Truman, others, they write their voice. I hope I write my voice. I don't know. I sometimes don't know that I do. And, of course, in a news story about a fire killing a child, that's not going to be your voice. I mean, something fun. You know, I'm just talking about, in generally, though, you're going to write, you know, the way you think and according to your own personality. And here's the chapter, just a couple of things. He advises, and I think this is right, don't alter your voice to fit the subject. You should kind of try to write everything, especially when you write blogs. The things you guys are going to try to write, if it's not news, hard news, and most of you aren't going to write hard news, I mean, you should write the same way about everything. I mean, I try to write pretty much, whether I'm writing a blog or writing academic stuff, I use the same voice. In fact, I was warned by one of the PhD supervisors I had, not supervisor, one of the guys on my committee, we're really watching you because we think you're going to write in a really popular style. And I said, well, I'm going to write in whatever my style is. I don't know any other way to write. This is how I've written. And it turned out to be fine. I mean, it was clear. I think it was, you know, the language is simpler. I mean, it was history. And as it turned out, this particular member really liked it. And I think he thought we used a lot of cliches. I don't know that he understood news writing, but I do try to write, you know, everything kind of the same way. And again, I think you see Russ and Dr. Moore and others that way. Let's see. I'm just going to, you guys get this. I don't read this. So John Piper talks about taste in words. You have that essay? Take that out if you have the essay. Let's talk a bit about that. I want to talk more about that than in terms of taste. So get Zinser and do the sound of your voice. I can have this photocopied and sent to you. But I think that'll come over time as you write. Just write. And again, don't try to be too stilted or, you know, just write the way you talk. Unless you're from Georgia, I have to write in a way I don't talk. So, I write hopefully better than I talk. But here's a quote from his address on Christian eloquence. The attempt to craft striking and beautiful language makes it possible that the beauty of eloquence can join the beauty of truth and increase the power of the word, your words. When we take care to create a beautiful way of speaking or writing about something beautiful, the eloquence, the beauty of the form, reflects and honors the beauty of the subject and so honors the truth. The method and the matter become one, and the totality of both becomes a witness to the truth and the beauty of the message. If the glory of Christ is always ultimately our subject, and if He created all things, and if He upholds all things, then bringing the beauty of form into harmony with the beauty of truth is the fullest way to honor the Lord. He's saying that there is such a thing as Christian eloquence. He uses John Calvin as an exemplary model of this, and I think this is true. One of you guys, we were talking about reading the Institutes today. How many of you have read the Institutes of Christian Religion? How many of you have read? Not cover to cover, and not as Tom Chandler says, word for word and carefully, but how many of you have read some of the Institutes? What did you think about? Were you surprised? Did you expect it to be a lot of big words and kind of pedantic? And were you pleasantly surprised at how the beauty of the language and the simplicity? Yeah, I remember the first time I read the Institutes, I was very surprised. I love the way Calvin weds biblical truth with arresting prose. I mean, and that's what Piper says, captures the heart and mind. It's not clunky at all. Here's just an example of Calvin. Calvin's writing. Without the gospel, everything is useless and vain. Without the gospel, we are not Christians. Without the gospel, all riches is poverty, all wisdom, folly before God. Strength is weakness, and all the justice of man is under the condemnation of God. But by the knowledge of the gospel we are made, children of God, brothers of Jesus Christ, fellow townsmen with the saints, citizens of the kingdom of heaven, heirs of God with Jesus Christ, by whom the poor are made rich, the weak strong, the fools wise, the sinners justified, the desolate comforted, the doubting sure, and slaves free. The gospel is the word of life. That's beautiful. And there's not any big words in there. Most of those are two-syllable words or one-syllable words, aren't they? But it's beautiful. The gospel is the word of life. Here's another section from the Institutes. If we seek salvation, we are taught by the very name of Jesus that it is of Him. If we seek, and I think seek, if is that it's conditional. He's kind of pegging on this conditional word. If we seek any other gifts of the Spirit, they will be found in His anointing. If we seek strength, it lies in His dominion. If purity, in His conception. If gentleness, it appears in His birth. For by His birth He was made like us in all respects that He might learn to feel our pain. If we seek redemption, it lies in His passion. If acquittal, in His condemnation. If remission of the curse, in His cross. If satisfaction, in His sacrifice. If purification, in His blood. If reconciliation, in His descent into hell. If mortification of the flesh, in His tomb. In newness of life, in His resurrection. If immortality, in the same. If inheritance of the heavenly kingdom, in His entrance into heaven. If protection, if security, if abundant supply of all blessings, in His kingdom. If untroubled expectation of judgment, in the power given to Him to judge. In short, since rich store of every kind of good abounds in Him, in Christ, let us drink our fill from this fountain and from no other. That's beautiful, isn't it? But he's just very simple. It's compelling. Of course, the gospel is always compelling. But Piper, it's one of the things he quotes, I think, is an example of how to be eloquent in simplicity. Let's flip over, let's see, in the essay, to what he says. He's got two-pronged criterion on page, mine's page 8. He speaks of the Bible as eloquent, and then what 5 benefits of Christian eloquence. Number 4, speaking memorably. This can help answer some of the questions about, you know, how do we use one word lead? Do we use one? How is it? I mean, is it eloquent? Here's some good advice from Piper, I think. Certain kinds of eloquence, cadence, you know, the way something sounds, the sort of the rhythm, parallelism, meter, rhyme, assonance, and consonance may not only interest and awaken the heart, but increase the impact by making what is said memorable. That is, more easy to remember or memorize. Consider the title of this conference. This is from one of the Desiring God conferences. I'm very picky when it comes to the cadence and consonants of consonants and assonance. I worked on the title the same way I worked on the poem, The Power of Words and the Wonder of God. That was the conference title, The Power of Words and the Wonder of God. I want it to be pleasing and memorable. So first there's an intentional cadence in the meter that I find pleasing, The Power of Words and the Wonder of God. And I that is pleasing to the ears, isn't it? If you read that out loud, you think, yeah, I like that. I do headlines this way. I'll read headlines out loud. They've got to please, they've got to be pleasing to my ears, so or I won't let them stand. I'll change them. Second, there's consonance or alliteration between the W's in words and wonder. And again, this isn't super silly, is it? This isn't silly, just a bunch of alliteration to alliterate. No, it's the words and wonder of God. Compare the power of language and the wonder of God. Okay, that was one thing he could have called it. Or the power of words and the majesty of God. Both cadence and alliteration are lost in both of those things. Both of those titles. Third, there's assonance. 6 of the 9 words are dominated by the sound of the letter O. Power of words, wonder of God. Compare the strength of language and the marvel of deity. Not as good. Finally, I think the juxtaposition of words and wonder and God is unusual, provocative, and attractive. All of that, I think, helps people remember the title, not because it is displeasing the way 9/11 is remembered because it hurt, but because it is aesthetically satisfying. Next year, and this has happened already with Calvin in the Theater of God, iambic pentameter, so we can't add John Calvin's first name. So I think there's something to this. This is why you should read your prose out loud, so that you have these, you know, these elements in it, and read it to see if it's pleasing. Because I will write something, then read it out loud, and go, that isn't good. I'll change it. I do that a lot, especially with headlines. But I read a lot of my writing. I'll try to read out loud. Certainly as power in words, we need to take that seriously. I mean, that's why I do this. That's why I love words, because God has given us His Word. He has inspired a book, lo and behold. And I think we need to be serious about using words compellingly, to use words that are pleasing, using words that glorify God, in a way that glorifies God. And I think, you know, we've seen some good examples of that today. One thing I want to commend to you that I think we have in our packet, there's some stories in here from World Magazine, just some examples that will give you exactly what I'm speaking of. It'll give you just examples. Let's see, I'm trying to just look at the Spirit of St. Louis. This article has this. Print these off the web. The Spirit of St. Louis. Okay, this is just... These are good illustrations of what all the things I've talked about in terms of leads and stories today. This is a story, the Spirit of St. Louis, on Christian training job programs, working hard to help their students become employable and in some cases employed. Well, you know, on the surface of that, that just doesn't really compel you, does it? It's kind of like, story about job training. Wow. Well, I like what they did with it. And this is how you do it. I love the lead. With 35 years of experience in human resources, Lane Hardy knows a thing or two about how to get a job. And then he quotes him. And so it's this whole illustration of Lane Hardy, who knows a thing or two, who's gifted in this area. And so you have more of he's painting a picture of, or using an illustration of how she'll go about getting jobs, of how this program they're going to go on to write about works. It's distilled in this person. So it summarizes really what the story is about in this illustration. I think that is really well done, so you can read the rest of that at your leisure. You may have read that already. Let's see. I think I had another article in here. Well, here's the Gospel Ground Zero, Russ Moore, Christianity CT. This was the cover story this month, Christianity Today. Dr. Moore had this. I love the first sentence. In America, we debate our wars not with just heated speeches, but also with dueling banjos. After the attacks on September 11, 2001, the radio dial seemed to lurch between the children of Woodstock and the heirs of the Grand Ole Opry. That's a good lead. I like that. He's going to write about country music. But he's not going to write about country music. He's going to write about what we should think about 9/11. After 9/11, what we should think about war in light of 9/11. But he's found a way, he's found a cultural point, a cultural peg to hang this on, where the in the culture you see the debate of how we should view 9/11. You have the heirs of Woodstock and then the heirs of Grand Ole Opry. They're singing different songs. And that's what he's going to write about. And he's going to, of course, fill its significance with gospel significance of how, you know, how the gospel was the ultimate act of terrorism, but how redemption's found in that, and how we ought to find redemption, you know, in the themes from Ground Zero. But anyway, I love the way he starts that out. And he's got a song by Darryl Worley he quotes there, and I like this song. You take off all my footage off my TV, it's too disturbing for you and me. And he goes on, he kind of builds into that song. I actually wrote a piece about that song for 9/11 too, totally different than this, but it's funny. I emailed him and said, hey, we're stealing each other's stuff. His was better than mine. Again, I wanted to go back and go, I'll write this way. But I like the way he gets into this. And this is something a lot of people can relate to because it's compelling, it's interesting. And I mean, I just sat down and read the whole thing. Of course, it's my friend, and he's from Southern and all that. I would have, but if I had known him, I still would have read that because I'm interested in the Grand Ole Opry and the Children of Woodstock. Or that resonates with me. Let's see. I think that's all. There may be another article in here of World Hiring on Hold. Mountain of the regulations of job training. Or small businesses, job trainings in small businesses. You can look at that. Just some good examples. And I've got an excellent essay by John Updike. It's on baseball. And I love baseball. I used to be a baseball writer, and I love the history of the game. I love the nature of the game. The same way George Will loves baseball. I mean, it's very conversational. You can go and consider the ball game and eat hot dogs and talk to your son or talk to your wife or have a conversation. And yet, I'll miss the game. And so, being 5'7", it's a game I played. My dad played. Have you ever heard of Brooks Robinson? Played one of the great third basemen. I'm actually distantly kin to him, so that's kind of my family's thing. But I like baseball because of the history tied to the game. And it's a bit of a literature sprung up around baseball. It's actually quite good. And this is a very famous essay. Hub fans bid the kid adieu. Who's this talking about? Who can tell me? Baseball trivia here. Who is it? Ted Williams, that's right. What's the Hub? Hub fans. Boston. He was probably with the Boston Red Sox. Greatest hitter of all time, perhaps. But I love, this is just so well written. And this is, I like to hold this up as an example of just good writing. And he was a reporter and an essayist. Fenway Park in Boston, a lyric little band box of a ballpark. Everything is painted green, and it seems in curiously sharp focus, like the inside of an old-fashioned peeping-type Easter egg. I know what that is. I like that. It looks kind of like a bowl, right? One of those. Yeah, I like that. You see the metaphor here, or the comparison. Yeah, I love that. The word picture. It was built in 1920, rebuilt in 1934, and offers, as do most Boston artifacts, a compromise between man's Euclidean determinations and nature's beguiling irregularities. Its right field is one of the deepest in the American League, while its left field is the shortest. The high left field wall, 315 feet from home plate along the foul line, virtually thrusts its surface at right-handed hitters. And he goes on to recount this, and it's just really good. It's about Ted Williams' last at-bat. And he homered in his last at-bat. And he goes on to say how there was a curtain call for Ted Williams that day. You know, the fans knew this would be his last at-bat. He hits it out, circles the base. He ran. He sprinted around the bases with his head down. And the last line in here, I think, is... The fans gave him a curtain call, but he didn't come out because gods don't give curtain calls. And he's not talking about big gods, but little g gods don't give curtain calls. And that's part of his point. He's writing an essay about Ted Williams, but he starts talking about some of the physical properties of Fenway Park. I love where he starts. That draws me into it. And even if I didn't care about Ted Williams, I would likely read it because it's very, very well read, or well written, rather. And he goes into Williams and some of his triumphs and suffering within the game and all this stuff. And it's just really well done. So whether you know or you care about baseball, read that. It's a good, I think, an example, a secular example of the kind of writing I would like to see you guys do, and I think is being done in evangelicalism among the young, restless reform crowd, if you want to call it that, today. So that's what I've got. We're going to talk about, you've got a handout in there on interviews. It's just five or six things. I'll leave you with this, and then we'll do Q&A for the last however long you want to stay. I'll stay. I'm here for the weekend. So don't waste your journalism. Why is this good for you? Why is it good for you to do this kind of writing? I mean, you've wasted better part of a Friday here with me, right? I hope you haven't wasted. I hope it's not wasted. But why is this good for you? Why is this good for you to give yourself to this kind of discipline? Well, here's just a handful of reasons. And this just comes right out of my own experience. This is ways that it's helped, that being this kind of writer has helped me in seminary, but more than that, in ministry. And I think it'll help you as well. First is the stewardship of deadlines. This will help you. Doing this kind of writing has helped me to avoid procrastination. I'm used to being on deadline, and I don't actually work very well if I'm not on deadline. But the stewardship of deadlines, the stewardship of time. I mean, we only had, at the newspaper, we had to put out a paper every day, so we couldn't linger along over things. We couldn't procrastinate, even though reporters, I'm definitely bent toward procrastination like us all, but you can't procrastinate and meet the deadline. And, you know, if you pastor, I'm learning by experience that Sunday comes every week. It's every 7 days, like clockwork, until Jesus comes, and sometimes I wish he would before Sunday. You know, you're going to preach. You're going to have to get on some kind of clock. You're going to teach and preach and stand before those people, and you better be prepared to speak on behalf of God through the Word. So there's a stewardship that comes with deadlines, and there's nothing worse than a lazy preacher or the sermon thieving preacher or whatever. There's no greater blight on the ministry than that, in my estimation. Secondly, it instills in you an ability to be concise. You know, Proverbs 10:19 speaks of the sin of too many words. And when words are many, sin is not lacking. So this kind of writing forces you to be concise in the articulation of your words, but also in your thinking. You have to think in big categories and bring a lot of information together, which is my third don't waste your journalism point. Is it will instill in you the ability to synthesize and accurately summarize massive portions of info. So when you're sitting in Greg Will's class and you've just read a 500-page church history book and he says, "What's it about?" Your mind is that you're able to tell him, "It's about this. It's about the nub." And because, I mean, in evangelism, what are you doing? You're synthesizing 66 books into a couple-minute presentation, right? You're really having to bring a lot. There's a lot of information in the Bible. I mean, there's Israel, there's the creation, the fall, there's redemption, there's all that stuff. There's no. But it's all brought about in creation, fall, redemption. New creation. That's it. That's what it's about. That's a good summary. So you'll begin to think in categories like that. It'll really help you. It helped me with my dissertation, for example. I had 10,000 pages of original source, primary source material. It bound in books about, I mean, it was, you know, this high, two stacks. And I'd read a lot of it, and I'd chronicle it. I'd put together a methodology, sort of annotated bibliography, and I'd, you know, it was about 300 pages itself. And I just sat down and thought, what in the world am I going to do with all this? I had to come up, and I didn't have a year to begin my dissertation. I didn't want a year because I didn't want to pay, you know, I didn't want to pay the tuition, you know, for the rest of my life. So I had to think in big categories. Okay, what's this all about? But by God's grace, my mind was kind of trained to think that way. And Dr. Nettles, my supervisor, always pointed out, you're really trained to think this way, so this is playing to your strength, and it really did. Here's a lot of information, but here's the nub. I mean, I don't get everything in there, but here's the nub, and here's what my dissertation's about. And I was able to stick to that well enough to pass, and I'm very thankful for that. I don't want to redo on that at all. Fourthly, it helps you to write better sermons and teaching outlines to show the Bible versus tell the Bible. To show the effects of sin versus telling the effects of sin. I mean, it's helped me to craft. Writing an outline is not a foreign thing to me to summarize some information. I've done that. I did that every day for 15 years before I came to seminary, and it will really equip you to do that. Sixthly, or fifthly rather, it will instill and give you the ability to write more clearly and thus more compellingly. So no more dull kind of obscurantist paragraphs or papers. You'll begin like the example from Strunk and White from Ecclesiastes we read earlier. That, you know, you won't write anything like that. I've seen that done. And I have owned books. I have lots of books on my bookshelf, but I haven't read cover to cover many of them. I don't like to read those books. I like books that are clear. R.C. Sproul is one of my heroes. John Piper is one of my heroes. J.I. Packer is one of my heroes. And they're my heroes partly because they can write well and make it really clear. And my 75-year-old mother in Georgia can take R.C. Sproul's book on election, and she might not like it, but she'll understand it. She'll flat get what he's saying in there and be enough to be outraged and want to take this book and throw it at her youngest son. She gets it because he's clear. He's taking this massively, this massively articulated doctrine that's from Genesis to Revelation and then brought it down to this book. And boy, you get it. And there's implications. And my mother had not read a lot of advanced theology. She read that. Boy, she got it. And I heard about it. And that was good. That proved my point that Sproul is accessible. And you want to be accessible. John Piper's having a major impact for a reason. And R.C. Sproul has too. They're clear. And their works are not filled with pedantics and all those things. So I think that's one of the reasons why God has given them an ability to articulate. Dr. Moeller, Russ Moore, the guys I've talked about here, Carl Truman, compellingly but clearly, not a lot of $5 words. They don't learn a new, I knew a writer who would learn a new big word every day. A dictionary, I've never done that. It was like a catechism to him, but that's okay. I've never found much use for those words. I don't know them. Sixthly, the ability to make the difficult and abstract clear and concrete. And this is crucial in your teaching theology. If you get it, you will be able to instruct others clearly. Take big, difficult concepts, abstract concepts, and make them clear and concrete so that you can teach others. I think our professors here are experts at this. Tom Schreiner and Bruce Ware and Steve Wellum and all the rest, they're really good at taking these big, erudite concepts that even our minds can't even contain, and their minds can't completely contain it because God is incomprehensible, finally. But they take it and make it very clear for us to learn so we can go teach it to other people. And so, again, you have to ask my people about that. They might laugh at this. They may mock this whole enterprise here that I'm undertaking, but I hope not. Finally, it will, I think, help you to carry out the mandate of 1 Corinthians 10:31. Which I quote in my prayer. So then, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all things to the glory of God. I mean, the Scripture has a lot to say about words, about being careful with words. I mean, it talks about gossip and slander and the reckless use of words and all those things. But and I do mean that, but I don't mean that. I mean, we've been given a stewardship. We've been given a book of words. God has chosen to reveal Himself in a book. And so that tells me that God takes words and the Word very seriously, and so must we. And so I want you, my brothers and sisters at Southern Seminary, and I love this place and I love our students here. And I told Dr. Moeller, you've had a lot of smarter alums, but never a prouder alum of this place. I love what I'm seeing here. Go out and write for the glory of God, and you'll make an impact. I see guys all the time from here and in other places. I mean, guys, Kevin DeYoung and Justin Taylor, and you know all the guys you read, they're making a huge impact because they write well. And that's part of it. That's not all of it, of course. I mean, there's got to be godliness and the gifts, and the Holy Spirit has to imbue them behind all that. Of course, I hope we assume that. But to go and write for the glory of God. And I look forward to seeing what comes out of here. And I hope this has been some encouragement for you to do that. Questions? Just ask anything. Well, ask anything about this. Aaron. Yeah, I think that's my part of my don't waste your journalism. This will equip you. I mean, to do that, if you've got to write a 20-page paper, and you have, I don't know how many. Let's say your professor says you have to have 10 primary sources. If you're going to write 20 pages, you'd need to have probably 20, 15 for me or something like that. And I think that's pretty standard academic paper. Well, you've got a lot of information. You have a lot of reading to do. It's a lot of reading, a lot of note taking, a lot of research. And then you have to do something with what you've read, and and always let your research drive your thesis, by the way. That's why I think it's good. Here's a good a good methodology for academic papers that'll help you with the answer to this question. Have a research question? And a thesis. Always a thesis. And the research question will never change. I'm going to investigate the rise of open theism in the 1970s in Southern Baptist seminaries. That's, or what, you know, and say, but the question I'm going to answer is, you know, what is Clark Pinnock's role in the rise of the popularization of open theism in the Southern Baptist seminaries in the 1970s? Clark Pinnock's an open theist. So used to be a Southern Baptist professor in New Orleans Seminary. That would be your research question, and that wouldn't change, and that would guide all your research. But your thesis would be shaped by what your research turned up. Well, here was the role. After you've done, read and assessed all the research, this will help you kind of, again, kind of synthesize all the information, see patterns in there and say, here's what I'm going to argue. And I'm going to show, I'm going to prove, but I'm going to show and not so much tell. I'm going to take the next 20 pages to show you that Clark Pinnock was the main, he was the key theologian who drove the rise of, the popularization of open theism in Southern Baptist seminaries in the 1970s. I mean, I don't think that's true. I'm just for the fun of it. Let's say that's your thesis. And then everything serves both that answering that research question to prove that thesis and nothing else. And again, I think this does equip you to think in those broad categories and think about bringing things together, because when I had to go back to the newsroom and write about something I'd covered, you know, I couldn't write about astronomy and, what you know, couldn't write about you know, something for the food page. I had to write about the car wreck I just covered, the legislature, whatever it was. I had a ton of information. I would cover, the thing I hated most was covering a court case. I'd cover a trial all day, and they'd talk and talk, and there'd be witnesses, and, you know, you'd have 10 or 12 hours of this, and maybe a big trial, covered a couple of murder trials, and, man, you had to just take this bewildering stack of information to make sense of it for the reader. But you're doing the same thing in an academic paper, in a book. The book Michael Haken and I are writing together. It's on the Great Commission vision of John Calvin. We're arguing something that, boy, it's going to be controversial because you know, people want to see John Calvin as being anti-missions or you know, undermining missions or whatever. But I've had to read and read and read. It's been wonderful because Calvin is a delightful writer. But I've got to, and I've had to, in my chapters, distill all that down into just what will fit in, you know, 40 pages of written prose. And so this helps you do that. So really will help you with academic papers, I think. It did me. Of course, I had an extensive background in this, but I mean, just learning to think this way, I think, puts you money ahead. Does that answer your question? Does that help? I mean, you don't have to write your essays in just a real breezy style. I don't mean that. I mean, you need to, you know, it needs to be, have academic rigor, but it should be clear. I don't think it should be unclear. Yes, sir. Yeah.
You just tend to skim through and get a sense of, okay, what events happen without focusing too much on the quality of how that's reported. But then there's sort of a rise in blogs and opinion articles and sort of the analysis that goes beyond that. I guess I wonder if you could talk a bit about sort of the difference between the very heavily fact-based reporting kind of writing and then a writing that is more focused on opinion and analysis. And
yeah. Sure. Well, I think they're similar. And I think they're similar in this way. Even your opinion, again, should show me why your opinion's true. I mean, if you tell me chocolate ice cream is superior, there's no way to prove that, right? And then, you know that. I mean, that's intuitive. I mean, you can't, or, you know, rock and roll is superior. Well, I know, I mean, no, you can't prove that. But if you say to me, you know, something like, you know, I believe evangelical Calvinism has the propensity or the potential to bring about a more profound change in the church, contemporary church, than the emerging church does. Well, you can give me a lot of information, you can do a lot of reporting and investigation to back that up. I mean, I think your writing should always have good facts. And when I'm preaching the Bible, I'm not preaching my opinion, ever. I mean, almost, I don't know if I ever give my opinion unless it's, here's a very a very hotly disputed text, and there's a lot of good men on both sides of the issue, and I'm not sure where I fall, and here's what I think, but I'm always really clear to say this is what I think, but when I am exegeting the text, I am proving to them from the text that this is what the text says, and this is then how we should live. And so I think even a good blog post will have a lot of facts in it, because it will show me that what you're saying holds water and not just tell, because I really don't care what you think any more than you should care what I think. I mean, you read Dr. Moeller's blog every day. It's usually his take on something in the culture, but he's got all the facts. He will make an argument from. He's an old newspaper guy. Dr. Moeller was the editor of the Christian Index in Georgia, the Baptist State paper, in the late 80s. And my parents say that, you know, the paper's never been the same since he left, and it probably hasn't. But he will take good facts and use that to prove his case. That's showing versus telling. I think all good. I tend to not read blogs that just give me their opinion. I mean, unless it's John Piper giving me his opinion or Albert Moeller or someone. But even then, they will always show me. I don't know if they ever just tell me, you should believe this. That's just kind of blind allegiance. I mean, the Christian faith is not just a blind leap of faith. We believe it because it's true. It's objectively true. We're not here building our lives around a fairy tale, and I don't think we should, opinions. And that's why I don't find the secular media's opinion very compelling, because typically it's just, well, these evangelical Christians are knuckleheads. Well, I mean, we might be knuckleheads, but why do you think we're knuckleheads? I mean, you know what I mean? There's just not a lot of stuff that really show me why they really don't like us. I mean, there's not a real case made. There's just a lot of rhetoric. I mean, rhetoric has a long storied tradition, but I mean, rhetoric in the way we typically use it today, I don't think is very helpful, just for the sake of rhetoric. And unfortunately, in the SBC, we have a lot of rhetoric. There are those out there who don't like what we're doing here, for example, some. But it's just a lot of rhetoric. I don't see, we're writing a book answering the John 3:16 conference. I'm contributing to a book that a bunch of guys here at Southern are writing. I mean, Shiner and Ware and Nettles and several others, but we're arguing in some cases against, and I've read the book on the other side, and it's just a lot of, well, that always undermines evangelism, we think. That kind of theology. Well, why does it show us? Well, no, it just does, because if God is sovereign, then you couldn't do evangelism. No one could do evangelism. You know, I've yet to meet one of these people who undermines evangelism. I mean, show me that, and I'll be disturbed and concerned, and we'll go rebuke those people. But no one ever shows me. That's just rhetoric. And so rhetoric just never compels me. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yeah, I want apologetics. I want apologetics, but I also want to deal with presuppositions. I mean, really, I want to deal with all these things because I think I want you to prove it. I mean, the question I asked when I went off to college, I'd been in church my whole life, but I wasn't compelled by what I heard there. I'd never heard the gospel. I'd never heard good theology. I'd never heard anything. The pastor screamed and yelled about women wearing pants and smoking cigarettes and all that. Women were just, boy, they really was bad. My mom, I don't have my mom surviving that, you know. I guess it wasn't just smoking women, but it wasn't compelling because it was just his opinion about the King James Bible and you name it. I mean, everything that seemed to be fun, he seemed to be against. That was the only sort of objective thing I could find. If it makes you smile, this man wants to stamp it out at every turn. So, I mean, that's what I took from the pastor when I was a child, honestly. And I went to college and I wanted to describe, I mean, I believed that Jesus was who he said he was. I believed the Bible was true for some reason. By God's grace, I believed it. But, you know, when I heard those professors, I thought, they seem to have a lot of stuff to back it up. You know, evolution, they got all these facts. Well, I realize now, you know, they got this research. Well, I realize the research is kind of a mist, but they had more than what I'd heard. And I didn't buy into that. Again, God protected me. But then when I really began to study theology, I realized, no, this does have, there is objectivity. This isn't a fairy tale. And before, it was just kind of, this is what I believe and it works for me. I was very almost postmodern because I didn't know anything else to believe because I'd heard about, I knew I couldn't tell my professor you shouldn't smoke and you shouldn't date a woman who wears pants. And that's what you shouldn't do because that's what the Christian faith seems to be where I come from. And so, and a lot of Southern, a lot of really, really, really sappy music about grandma and all that stuff. I mean, that's what I was raised. And there's just nothing objective in that. So that's why I find theology, the Christian theology, so compelling. Because it's biblical and it's objective. And so, yeah, I do. I want to prove it. I've always been that way. But the Christian faith will stand every time. I'm not afraid to go in the marketplace and argue these things because it'll stand. I mean, you guys know, you've studied church history like I have. We've got a great intellectual tradition. There's a very, very deep and wide intellectual tradition in among evangelicals from the Reformation to now and even before the Reformation. So we don't have to back down one toe. Yes, sir.
What are some areas of growth that you would see across the board, maybe every area? It seems like there's a big lack of real quality substance of this type being produced by the local church, maybe except for actual like specific pastors.
Yeah. Well, I think I want more writing pastors. I want more guys like you to come here and learn good theology, learn how to articulate, and go out into churches and start a blog for your church. I've got a blog that I write to every week. We deal with gender issues. And my people, I mean, it's a Reformed church, so they know it's true. But, I mean, we're really deepening their knowledge of that. And I see, you know, these 500-word essays I write about three times a week as part of that. I mean, I'll write on sanctification, or I do book reviews. I recommended Dr. Moeller's Atheism Remix. We do a feature every Friday. It's a book review. And I just give them a couple hundred-word summary of the book and a link to Amazon and say, go get it. And they do. We even sell them in our church. We've started stocking our library with some of these things, and they're reading. I mean, just encouraging them and writing for them, giving them something they can take home. Our senior citizens in our church, we're probably 70% 50 and under, and about 30% 50 and over. But those senior citizens have become, I kind of am surprised, they really love that because they're readers. They're used to printing things off, and they will print a whole pile of my blog posts for a scene, and they take them home with me, and I've got a lady named Rosie Wright. She's 77 years old, and she's never wrong, but she's really engages these things. She'll take this home, and she'll read, follow some of the, get online and click on some of the links I have on there and read other things, and she said, I'm really learning through these things. It's really helpful, but it gets very simple, very clear. I mean, justification by faith. Boy, I never thought about this. And that other guy, that Sproul guy, boy, he's really got a lot of good things to say about that. You know, but praise God, she's doing that. So that's what I think the take-home value for pastors is. Go right. I've got a friend named Jerry Marcellino. Some of you may know Jerry. He's a pastor in Laurel, Mississippi at a Baptist church down there. And he writes a column every week for the local newspaper, kind of like the North Georgia News. And it's wonderful. And he always sends it out to a bunch of people and says, pray that this article will have an impact. And it's just a 500 or 600-word article on Luther and the Reformation, or justification by faith, or what is sanctification, or, you know, some question like that. But it's a real clearly, simply worded article with even other, a couple of books to read, by the way, and, you know, just pray that God will use that to plant seed. I see that as a big part of my ministry that God has equipped me for through all these years in newspaper business. It really goes well, I think, with a local pastorate. At least it does for me, and I expressed that to my, when they were recruiting me, and interviewing me, I said, this is going to be a big part of my ministry. I hope you understand. They were fine with it. And, you know, even coming here to teach you these things, they're very supportive. But they said, this is what we want. So, yeah, I think it has great potential. I mean, because if you blog, the younger people are going to read your blog. I mean, the people are used to going online for everything. We'll read your blog and then get your secretary to print it out for your older folks. And they'll usually, I mean, at least out of curiosity, at least if they don't agree with you, they'll want to find some place they can criticize you or impugn your motives. You know, they'll take it and read it. And my people aren't doing that. I think they're reading it because those disappear from our little desk outside every week. And I'm glad, not because I think, you know, they think they love me. I mean, though, I want them to read it. So I hope it's having some kind of impact. But be good writers. I mean, I may never write the R.C. Sproul best-selling book. That's not what I'm after. I want to see church history, theology, church history, biblical exegesis, all these things take root in the local church, and my writing is a part of that, I think, for lay people, like my mama in Georgia. Anything else? Almost quit on time. I think I said everything I wanted to say. You have some good examples in those packets. Yeah, take a look at what these guys are doing. These are my guys here. These are so well done. They look great, but they read well. I mean, these guys have been well trained. We got some good writers here, and we've had good writers for a long time here. I know that's something that our Dr. Moeller and our faculty take very seriously. So when you get these, don't just think. I mean, they're not soliciting funds here. This is robust and substantive. We made a decision when I first came here in '99. there was a push to make this kind of a puff piece and say, well, we're gonna solicit funds. Now, we solicit funds in other ways, but this is not the main goal for this magazine. Jim Smith, who's my boss when I first came here, is now the editor of the Florida Baptist Witness newspaper in Florida and doing a great job. One of the few Baptist newspapers that remains relevant because he thinks theologically. He said, I want to make this something along the lines of Christianity Today. We want to take a topic and let our faculty play into our strength. We have the greatest faculty in the world. Let them just tear it to pieces, tease it out. Write about what our students are doing for the glory of God. Let our alum know. I mean, I get this and I read about alumnus in here and it tells me what's going on, but it gives me meat. I mean, this one's on being serious about the gospel. We've got teaching about Jesus through the Old Testament, and which right here. Many of you may have gotten this, but there's some good essays in there about Christ in all the Bible, because here at Southern we take that, the Christological interpretative principle, very seriously, and we should. And that will give you even other resources. And give it to people. I give these to people. I get them, and you guys send me 2 or 3 copies, and I give them to people in my church, and they love this magazine. It's, wow, it's not asking for money. But I hope they'll send money, too, because I want them to support my seminary. But they do a great job here. And it's just gotten better. It's far better than, looks so much better than I was here. We had a bunch of writers here who didn't know how to think aesthetically. We could think aesthetically, we just couldn't do it. It's like I can show you how to hit a golf ball perfectly, but then I hit it in the woods when you see me do it. So it's kind of like, we knew what looked good, we just couldn't pull it off. So we're glad to have a team here that's made this look good now. It looks fantastic. It's second to none, in my opinion. It's a biased opinion, obviously.
What are some of your thoughts on probably having been in a lot of journalism? I'm sure now there's much more being produced without editors, without filters. So maybe your thoughts on whether content is getting better, worse, what to be looking at. Because I know, like, I hear the idea of blogging. I don't blog. But I feel like there's so many bloggers out there already that it's...
Yeah. Monotonous at this point. Yeah, I mean it's both a blessing and a curse, I think. And I know that's speaking out of both sides of my mouth, but there is more information. The good news is, okay, let's go with the blessing first. The blessing is the gatekeepers who are against us are no longer the only gatekeepers. Because the gatekeepers, the information, used to be the established media in the country. No, that's no longer the case. It's hard to slide it by the people anymore. And I like that. And bloggers are a big part of that. Because a guy can go on a blog and get, he can get his stuff posted. It may not be well written or very well vetted, but, whatever happened at, legislature today, he can get that up, or something, he knows about city council. I mean, he can get that up before the newspaper comes out tomorrow. And everybody's going to know about it and be talking about it. Now, that is the blessing. And I think there's been I don't think it's changed the media at all, because I think they're so arrogant that they think they're right. I really do. I believe that they're right, that the left is right. But I think there's a bit more gatekeeping that goes on, or at least should go on, let's say. I don't think it's made the... I think USA Today and the Washington Post and the LA Times and CNN and even Fox News and others, they would just say, probably not Fox News, they like bloggers, but they would just say, well, the bloggers, they'd make that argument. They're unwashed. And they're uninformed. They're highly uneducated. They tend to be evangelicals. So you really can't take them seriously. You need to listen to us. I think, when they say that, then run and read the blogs, because chances are, we're seeking to overturn the franchise, and papers have gotten smaller. So I think there's a blessing from that point, from that perspective. But I think the curse is just what you said. There's a lot of unguarded words out there, and there's a lot of unguarded opinions and opinions that present themselves as fact. So we have to be really, really careful in using information off the internet, or even believing things off the internet. My mother-in-law is always calling my wife and I with some wild tale off the internet about homeschool or some, I mean, and she's for it, but she's always like, we heard that when kids are, I mean, she heard some crazy thing about brain cancer for kids that use cell phones the other day, and said it was on a blog. And I said, well, that, part of me wants to say, well, there's your first mistake. I'm a blogger. Hold on a second. We want you to believe some blogs. So I think you just have to be really careful and very discerning. There are places to get good information. I think the Gospel Coalition blogs, all that stuff, I mean, that's really good. But you know those guys. Most of them are, they do know theology. They are reading the books. They're doing good things like that. And they are for the gospel. So, but still, we have to be careful. There used to be a, uh, there used to be a website called gospelfire.com. And it was a website created to expose Southern Seminary and reform people in Southern Baptist Convention as heretics. And now Baptist Fire had a picture of fire on the front. First of all, it had a big fire. It would actually go whoosh when you clicked on the thing, which made me skeptical at first, right from the beginning. But there was no name. It wasn't tied to anything. There were no names. They were gutless, in my opinion. It was laughable. I mean, the articles didn't have names on them. It was just accusations, a lot of rhetoric. No one took that seriously. We would go on there to see what they're saying about us. This was back in the earlier in this decade. It was fun to find out what they're saying about us. It was always, Dr. Nettles went through a thing one time where they were accusing him of being a Roman Catholic. And he's a noted Roman Catholic, of course. He grew up a Roman Catholic, but it's just funny. But that was one of the articles they had, but there was no name on it, you know. And those tend to be, I think they speak for themselves. So I think you guys certainly will know, I think, what's good and what's not. But now the lay people, you know, won't tell people in churches, be really careful. And this is where you can guide them as their pastor. Guide them. And I just did a blog post a couple weeks ago about here's some good stuff on the internet, good theology. And I gave them about 30 links. You have things like T4G, Dr. Mueller's blog, Justin Taylor, all the stuff, different things on the Gospel Coalition, Ligonier, Desiring God, Paul Tripp, just things that it's good, edifying, that I know and trust. And so you told them, you can trust this information. SBTS is on there. I know, they're tired of hearing about SBTS. No, you were on there. You made it. Because my writings are on there, so of course you made it. No, I'm teasing. In spite of my writings being on there, I think I did make a joke about that. This is not for you to send you to things I've written. There's still good stuff coming out of there. Hey, your app is on my iPhone, so it's right there. Just, I didn't know what an app was a year ago. Now I've got an iPhone, so that's a good thing. Did I, Emily? Remember that? I asked him, didn't I ask you once, what is an app? And you explained it to me, and it was great. I'm telling you, I've had to really adjust. It is. Yeah, so I'm always learning. Anything else? So it's only be a good steward of your time. It's 3:02. I go rescue my wife and my four children. They're at the pool, and I've not heard any bad news so far. That's a good thing, I think, so far.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. I hope this has been helpful. I pray that it was. I pray that, you know, all of you will go and by God's grace, make an impact for the kingdom. The glory of God, and I have no doubt you will, because I love what he's doing here. And you guys are a part of that. Like, I've been privileged to be a part of that.